Concorde killed supersonic flight. Apollo killed space exploration. I remember thinking, what? How is it that the most amazing airliner ever made is in a museum while nothing better is in the skies? Humanity went backwards.
Because the business model never really worked.
20% of seats at the front of the airplane, business class, are 80% of the profit dollars. This is like the business case for what we're doing and why it's working.
What do you hope the future of travel looks like?
What if you could go to London, have a dinner meeting, and come home and tuck your kids in the same night?
What's been the most counterintuitive lesson you've learned along the way?
The most surprising thing that I never would have predicted.
All right, Blake, thanks for doing this.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Welcome to New York.
Great to be here.
So at a high level, I want to talk about the history of aviation, and maybe we can start with some basic facts. So commercial airlines right now, if I'm flying from San Francisco to New York, how fast does that plane go?
It goes about 75 to 85% of the speed of sound.
Which is
like 600-ish miles per hour. And it hasn't changed in 50 years.
That was my next question. At one point in time, there was the Concorde, which went faster than that. Can you give people a little bit of a history on the Concorde airliner, how it came to be, what the commercial application of it was, and ultimately why it failed?
Yeah. So the first half century of aviation was really incredible progress. Of course, the first airplane was built by bicycle entrepreneurs in 1903, and who totally did not have the resume to do what they were doing. And there was a golden age of flight, really from 1903 through 1921, when all of the companies that we think of as great aviation companies were created, Boeing, Lockheed, Douglas, all created during that window. And then we had decades of really, I think, founder-led progress in aviation. Airplanes kept getting bigger, faster, safer, more comfortable. And it was generally commercially led. And then in the 1960s, of course, we had the Cold War and the leadership changed. In fact, the introduction of the first jetliner corresponds exactly with the retirement of the last founder. The first jetliner was the de Havilland Comet, introduced by de Havilland while he was still running his company. But by the end of the 60s, all the founders were gone. And of course, the Cold War was in full swing. And the world started to see technology as a symbol of national progress. And countries started leading the technology rather than industry. So we had, in the 60s, we had supersonic projects launched in Soviet Russia, in Europe, and in the US. And the European one was Concorde. And that was a joint venture between the French and British governments. And I find this really remarkable that it ever worked at all. Because usually when the French and British governments get together, it's a war, not an airplane, right? And you know, and they may or may not even be on the same side of the war. But so the goal of Concorde, much like Apollo, was to demonstrate the superiority of Western technology. Of course, there was, you know, basically there's this massive Russia versus the West. And trying to win over the rest of the world, you know, there's sort of this communism versus capitalism competition. And very ironically, in trying to compete, the West went the communist way. And we had this like centrally planned aerospace stuff. And so Concorde and Apollo were very much brethren on this. And I think I have a pretty radical view on this. Concorde killed supersonic flight. Apollo killed space exploration. You know, we had the moon landing and we had a Concorde flight, 1969. And I think if you'd stopped anybody in the street and said, tell me about 2025, no one would have said, we can't go to the moon and we can't fly supersonic. And yet I think both of those programs that were theoretically about demonstrating great progress are actually the death knell of progress. And the reason is both were done without any economics. I mean, Apollo was obvious, right? We spent a percentage of GDP to go land on the moon, and we plant a flag there, and we don't even know what to do next. And Concorde, in a way, was worse because it at least pretended to be commercial. Because, airlines will take this. People will buy tickets like it's a product. No, it's not. It's technologically very impressive, just the same way the moon landing was. But here's a 100-seat airplane with really cramped, uncomfortable seats, where in order to make any money, they ended up having to charge $20,000 for a round trip ticket. And you just can't find 100 people that want to spend 20 grand to go somewhere quickly. So the airplane flew half empty. It really only worked at all on a couple of routes. And it convinced the world that supersonic flight was economically impractical.
I want to drill into all of that stuff. You made the point earlier, or it felt like an implication that the founder-led transition or people moving out of their companies maybe had some implications for innovation. I don't know if that was the right framing of how you were sort of articulating it, or was it more the government stepping in, less the founder element?
Well, I think both of those are very, those are two sides of the same coin, right? Like, what's driving innovation? And if it's commercially driven, Adam Smith's hand is really helpful. And founders are pushing progress. They're looking for things that get to product market fit. They're always thinking about, is what I'm building actually useful? Or is it just a really great demo? And Concorde was a really great demo. It's a, you know, if it had come from a startup, the knock would have been that it never got to product market fit. And so the rise of national prestige-driven technology efforts and the decline of founders in aerospace, I think, are very much intertwined.
Yeah, I guess my question was, or the distinction I was trying to draw out, like CEOs can still push forward progress in some ways, and CEOs aren't necessarily the antithesis of government intervention or government pushing things forward. Founders maybe have some unique abilities to innovate in a lot of different fields.
Yeah. Well, if I just look at what actually happened in aviation, there was founder leadership through the 1960s. And then there was a kind of a new generation of leaders that were basically people who worked with the founders. And then the accountants took over. And that is very much the trajectory of Boeing, where in the last, it's been more than 20 years since Boeing's launched a new airplane. I just think about that, more than 20 years without an all new product. Like Apple goes for 18 months without updating something and people say they can't innovate anymore. 2 decades. And what happened was, really a couple things intertwined. One was just this focus on the next quarter and trying to run an aerospace company focused on the next quarter is like trying to fly an airplane while only looking straight down. It'll work okay for a little while, but pretty soon you're in a very strange place in the sky. Mm. And that's really what happened at Boeing. And at the same time, the political fallout of Concorde, because it was a competition between nations, was really disastrous. So after the American competitor to Concorde was canceled, we tried to protect Boeing from Europe. And so what do? We banned supersonic flight in the continental U.S. Literally, we put in place a speed limit. And everyone claimed it was because sonic booms were this massive problem. If that were really true, it should have been a noise limit, not a speed limit. The way supersonic flight should have started, the minimum viable supersonic jet would actually have been a private jet that was designed to fly from, say, Seattle to Miami. Carry a handful of people whose time is most valuable. And that small sort of minimum viable supersonic jet would have been easy to make quiet, easy to make economically viable. But if you can't fly supersonic coast to coast, there's no, basically the product's illegal. So we banned the minimum viable supersonic jet.
Well, and so I want to talk about that and the business model implications for the Concorde and the different regulatory considerations. But before we let this point go, I guess as we sort of zoom out, there was a lot of innovation that happened in society from with physical goods from 1900 to 1960 plus or minus, and it wasn't just aviation necessarily that started to stagnate in terms of innovation. It's true of critical infrastructure as well. Our ability to build trains or highways was amazing in the 40s, 50s, 60s. And now the cost of these things, the central planning, all of that. And so I guess I'm curious how much there's obviously the government intervention into the private sector, or at least trying to commercialize things that were out of scope historically for it, for maybe orthogonal means, which was showing off our technological superiority more than trying to build fundamental businesses, which I think is an interesting point. But I guess as you think about the regulations that maybe started to permeate the industry, even beyond the point about the Concorde and Sonic Boom and all that stuff, because I want to talk about that in a second, but were there other regulations introduced at that point in time in the 60s or 70s that really started this general stagnation of innovation?
Broadly, yes. I mean, there's a if you follow sort of history of technical progress, you find there was an inflection point around 1971 where a lot of positive trends vanished. Like prior to then, energy consumption per capita was on an exponential growth curve. And then the curve completely changed and it became a slow linear growth. And it got much, much harder to build things. And I think that the story is complex. I think at one level, it's cultural, where we went from utopian visions of the future. We went from like Jules Verne sci-fi to dystopian sci-fi. I think our motivation changed, but also we did things like the NEPA Act, which made it extremely difficult to build things physically and really easy for people to block stuff getting built.
Maybe explain the NEPA Act.
Yeah, so NEPA was the National Environmental Policy Act, and basically said, if you want to go build something, you're just going to be subjected to a whole bunch of environmental review, and anybody who doesn't like the project can sue. And so now we have projects that get mired in years, if not decades, of approvals. And just to give you one example, so we built a factory in North Carolina where we're going to build supersonic airliners, and it took as long to get the permit as it did to build the actual factory, and it took a year to get the permit. And by the way, people tell me that's a great time frame. That we did really well, that it only took a year. Why did it take a year? Well, we had to go through a noise review for how much noise the airplane would make after we were building them in the factory in order to start building the factory. And this is a noise review on an airplane that we're not even done designing yet, let alone actually building, where we have publicly committed it's not going to be louder than other jets. And yet, I can't roll a cement mixer until we've finished an environmental review. And it just is not, like, we're in our own way.
And do you think these are maybe well-meaning, well-intentioned people or policies that have just been taken to the outermost extreme? Or are there dark forces from other airline industries at lobbying play that are trying to make this a more difficult process?
I think both is the reality of it. I mean, everybody wants clean air and clean water.
Yeah, it's motherhood and apple pie. No one disagrees.
Nobody wants to be woken up in the middle of the night with the sound of, you know, something loud, right? Like obviously. But I think most regulatory stuff is there's always a moral cover story, which is very believable. And then there's what's actually driving it. And very often the actual driving is some kind of protectionist interest, or it's some kind of regulatory capture. If you're Boeing and your Concorde competitor just got canceled and all you've got is the 747, well, now you got to make supersonic jets the enemy, or at least that's what they thought they needed to do. And so now there was, I think, a lot of like funding of that opposition that was like secretly funded by industry. And, you know, I think we have business ethics all wrong. Business ethics should be things like, don't fucking do that. Like, regulatory capture is unethical. And we should not allow businesses to do it. And business leaders should be taught to play fair, not to use red tape to hamstring potentially better things.
The shift between the utopian sci-fi to the dystopian sci-fi, the 1971 culture shift, is there, it sounds like you've thought about this and looked at some of the different considerations around it in 1971. Is there any societal event at a cultural level that we look back on? I mean, obviously the 60s were a pretty transformative decade between, you know, different political leader assassinations, different civil leader assassinations, obviously the Vietnam War, all that stuff. Is there something societally that feels like it actually shifted as a moment in time?
I mean, I think so. I don't know if it's any one thing. These things are often lots of threads woven together that have a combined result much bigger than any one. I'm not aware of any like catalyzing.
Yeah, there wasn't.
It's not like, oh, it was Woodstock.
Yeah, or Watergate or, you know, something.
No, I think it's probably a lot of things in combination, but just generally, culturally, and then politically, a loss of focus on building a better future. And I think, you know, it was on the heels of, call it a century, of the future actually getting better and a loss of appreciation of what actually makes that happen. The future can be far, far better, but it isn't automatically far better. We have to actually make it better. And we have to not have things that get in the way.
So the Concord was French and British government get together. It's it sounds like they're not thinking through the business model necessarily in a meaningful way, like how this is actually going to work.
No.
They say this will be cool and then we'll figure it out later.
Basically, I mean, there was hand wavy economics, right? But it was not at all what, you know, any business minded person would have built first.
So first test flight was 69?
Yes.
And first commercial flight was when?
76.
76. And how many were made?
14 carried passengers.
14 carried passengers.
Right. And this is actually an important part of the story. The internet, so prior to me starting Boom, the internet was full of basically false conventional wisdom about supersonic flight. And one of those myths is, oh, it was 9/11 and one crash that killed Concorde. No. There were only 14. It was stillborn.
Yeah. So they didn't actually take it to the full extent. Well, I guess maybe let's talk about the different business models. So 14, how many people fit in?
100.
100 people.
100 packed in like sardines.
Packed in like sardines. And it flew how much faster than today's commercial airlines?
Almost 2.5 times.
2.5
so
times
it was Mach 2, which is twice the speed of sound, versus 0.75 to 0.85 for today's airplanes.
So U.S. to San Francisco, it could be, theoretically, that wasn't the route you were actually able to travel, right?
Yeah.
But that was 2.5, 2:45, maybe 3 hours, something like that.
Probably like 2.5 hours coast to coast.
Yeah.
Like that, if you'd actually flown it coast to coast.
If you had actually flown it coast to coast, which is an interesting story that we'll talk about in a second. But, okay, and how many people would fit on it?
100.
So 100 people, and they would charge
$20,000
in today's dollars.
In today's dollars.
Today.
Maybe it's more than that today. Yeah. But it's the again, this is Econ 101. The higher the price, the smaller the market, right? And so if you're going to make an airplane where the tickets are going to cost $20,000, and you're designing for 1970s or 80s market size, the airplane needs to be a lot smaller. What Concorde actually did is fly around a lot of empty seats. Even on the best route, which is New York to London, this is the like rock stars and royalty route, right? This is the, if you want to make a premium supersonic product, there is no better route than New York and London. And even on that route, it flew on average half empty.
And it flew half empty, presumably because of the price point.
Right.
And it sounds like some of the accommodations weren't crazy.
Yeah,
there.
So there's a vicious cycle that kind of spins here, right? So you start off with like, a high price point, an uncomfortable product. So that lowers demand. Now you can't keep the airplane flying all the time because there's not enough demand. So you got to schedule it so that like the first eastbound flight from New York to London would leave at 10 a.m. Out of JFK. Well, why 10 a.m.? Well, it's actually a terrible flight time. Right? And terrible is an exaggeration. It gets you to London after dinner. Versus if you leave a little bit earlier, you can make a late afternoon meeting, a dinner meeting, if you want, come home the same day. There's actually a much more compelling use case with an earlier departure. Well, why was it 10 a.m.? Well, they didn't have enough demand because of the cost and the comfort. And so they had to have a later departure so that connecting passengers would have time to connect onto a 10 a.m. departure. Mm. So you'd fly, say, from Chicago or Denver or whatever, early morning departure, and still make your 10 a.m. Concorde flight. But it's so all of that kicks off a vicious cycle. So now there's not enough demand. So then one of the economic advantages of supersonic is you can do more flights with the same airplane and crew. But you only realize that benefit if you've constructed the whole thing such that there's enough demand to keep the airplanes full and flying. So it's a whole, you know, it's a flywheel that's spinning in the wrong direction.
And so ultimately, the Concorde was disbanded when?
2003.
And they never made more than 14. It was sort of the same.
Yeah, 14. I mean, there were some prototypes and whatnot, but 14 carried passengers. Seven for BA, British Airways, seven for Air France.
Did it feel like it was on that inevitable path because the business model never really worked? Was there a public outcry at all? Were people upset about losing this or at that point the demand?
In a certain world, like, it's regarded as just this unbelievable tragedy. And there are still people campaigning today to get Concordes out of museums and put the literally actual Concordes back in the sky. I think it's something that has captured, it's captured a lot of people's emotional reaction because it is a symbol of going backwards, right? How is it? And this is like a little, in a certain sense, part of my own journey to doing this. When I was in my 20s in Seattle, I went to the Museum of Flight and I saw, the Concorde that was in the museum there. And I remember thinking, what? How is it that the most amazing airliner ever made is in a museum while nothing better is in the skies? Like, that seems wrong. Humanity went backwards. That's not how it's supposed to be. And I think that paradox, in a way, of regression is so contrary to much of the rest of technology that it is, it's almost like a murder mystery.
Structurally, as existing planes are today, like, what is the limiting force that hasn't allowed us to, it feels like so much of the digital world, we just get incrementally better in some way, shape, or form, right? Our iPhones, even the iPhones get better. Every new model that comes out is just works a little bit better. It's a little faster. Photos are better, all that stuff. Like, what is the structural limitation on just why we're not going from 650 to 675 to 700 on incremental planes?
Yeah. So the question is, what's the product for which there is product market fit at scale with somebody with a business incentive to deliver it? And so let's break that down. If supersonic flight over land were allowed, the Gulfstreams of the world would long since have delivered a supersonic business jet. And that would have kicked off exactly what you're describing, a whole cycle of innovation. We'd all be going Mach 5 by now. But we basically banned that product. So, okay, what would ordinarily be 2.0? What would be the first step beyond a supersonic private jet? Well, it would be a small premium supersonic airliner. So if we look at the economic anatomy of international air travel today, now this is really fundamental. This is like the business case for what we're doing and why it's working. 20% of seats at the front of the airplane, business class, are 80% of the profit dollars. This is why you have fancy wine lists, nice lounges. Essentially, all of the money on a per trip basis is premium international travel. And by the way, if you look at it on a passenger cohort basis, it's like 99%. The frequent flyers who fly at the front of the airplane are substantially all of the international airline profits. So Boeing and Airbus today, they make three class airplanes. You have business, premium economy, coach. Economically, that airplane balances because of the monetization in the front relative to the monetization in the back. So if you're Boeing today, you don't want to build an all business class supersonic airplane because it disrupts the bundling of the three class airplanes. So if Boeing shipped a all business class supersonic jet, it would undermine the market for 787s, undermine the market for 777s. Same story at Airbus. And because it's a duopoly, nobody blinks. Like, well, I won't do it if you won't do it. Okay. We can all kind of rest on our laurels. At an economic level,
I just want to understand that point. So if they, let's say, I think I'm probably in the 99%, given I'm bouncing all over the country at different times. And so I would love, obviously, to shift to a plane like you're describing. If that happens, then the Boeing has that in the sort of duopoly world. They sell it to United, for example. And then I now start flying that plane exclusively. How does that, wouldn't I shift over to what airline it is? Like if United's doing it and I'm a Delta member, wouldn't I shift to United? So it's like a net benefit to United to have this and therefore Boeing to have this?
Well, this is why United's doing exactly that. Well,
yeah, sure, sure. Let's take someone else that, not someone, your JetBlue, for example, or something. Like why, I guess from a business implication standpoint, I guess I'm not fully following why Boeing wouldn't be pushed to innovate or want to innovate on this.
It's duopoly market dynamics. And an unwillingness to cannibalize an existing product line. This is classic big company behavior in a duopoly market. Very few, and this goes back to the importance of founders. Like Steve Jobs was willing to destroy the iPod business to create the iPhone business, right? Boeing today, many CEOs removed from the founder, working for the board, being very focused on the next few quarters, is not willing to eat the 787 business to create a much larger supersonic business. If there was perfect competition, if there are lots of airplane manufacturers, they would have to because they would know that if they didn't do it, somebody else would. But there's only two. There's only Boeing and Airbus, right? And if you look at every Boeing product, there is an exact same Airbus product. The 787 and the A350, same airplane. 737, A320, same airplane. And you know, if you're a real av geek, you'll be like, oh, but the shape of the boarding doors. No, this, by the way, this is why the margins are terrible as well. When you have a competitor that has the exact same product line, the customers get to compete you down to like almost no margin, which is the story of Boeing's commercial business and Airbus's commercial business. Like they're terrible businesses because there's no product differentiation.
So we touched on this element of flying over water versus flying over land and the considerations from a regulatory standpoint about what's allowed and what's not. Can you talk about like how that came to be and what the implications of that are for different airliners?
So I think maybe the thing I should explain is what's the breakthrough that actually makes Boom possible here? Mm-hmm. Is that we've known how to build supersonic airplanes since 1947 when Chuck Yeager broke the sound barrier. We had Concorde. You can build a supersonic passenger jet. Like that's been done. The question really is, what is the right supersonic product to build that will make sense for a new entrant to build? And the our going in approach at Boom was for have any chance of succeeding at this as a startup, we would need to eliminate every conceivable risk systematically. So we're only using 20-year-old proven 787 level technology, things for which there's already a regulatory precedent. Basically, everything's pre-approved. And we are not assuming any changes in regulation. So what can you, if with those constraints, is the surprising thing is there's actually a great product to build. And that product is an all business class supersonic airliner designed to focus on the routes that are the transoceanic routes where you fly subsonic over land, supersonic over water. And it turns out with that constraint, there are about 600 routes on the planet where there's enough traffic to fill the seats at fares people are already paying that airlines can operate very profitably. And that turns into a multi-hundred-billion-dollar market for this product. And so think, you know, New York, London, but also Miami to Madrid and Seattle to Tokyo and DC to Paris. Literally, there are hundreds of these routes that have enough people flying business class today who would happily walk away from their business class to get a faster flight instead. And when we make the airplane only 64 seats, 64, by the way, really nice seats, that's important. Economically, it fits for airlines. If you can operate a Boeing or Airbus wide body and have profitability in your business class, you can operate a Boom Overture jet on that same route and have even better profitability because you'll be able to fill the seats of those passengers. They'll probably pay a bit more for speed. And you can do twice the flights of the same airplane and crew because it's faster. And there's enough demand to keep so you can sweat the asset.
And so subsonic over land, what's the fastest in the U.S. that you're allowed to fly?
So right now, 14 CFR 91.817. says thou shalt not exceed Mach 1, the speed of sound.
Mach 1, the speed, which is how fast?
It varies, but like, you know, think 700-ish.
700-ish. And so how did that regulation come to be?
Well, this was protecting Boeing from Concorde. So this was 1973. Congress had said, hey, FAA, figure out a way to protect the public from sonic booms that can be bad. And then what actually happened is we got a speed limit.
And sonic booms, for people that don't, I mean, I assume most people know what a sonic boom is, but can you just explain what
I think there's not much understanding of what a sonic boom is. It's, think of it as like the wake of a boat. And so, when a boat goes by, if you're like right next to a big boat, you'll feel a big wake. If there's a smaller boat or a boat further off on the other side of the lake, you know, the wake is smaller. But it is basically the pressure wave a supersonic airplane creates anytime it's supersonic. And today, because there are no commercial supersonic airplanes, there are only fighter jets. If you scramble a fighter jet and you fly supersonic at a low altitude, it makes a very loud sound. However, if you fly an airliner at 60,000 feet, it's a completely different story. And one of the breakthroughs that was not part of our original plan, but something we figured out along the way, is it could actually do it with no audible sonic boom.
So, and we'll show a picture on screen of, there was actually captured of what it looks like, and you can almost see the wake behind. And so I guess that's an important point, though. I think when people think of the sonic boom, there's the auditory element associated with it. And so what is that? What is the, when people, and when Boeing is lobbying against this, obviously people don't want huge loud noises flowing down and disrupting cityscapes or whatever, countrysides.
So I think what we're going to see actually happen is this could happen very quickly because nobody's opposing it now. And it just makes common sense. If there's a supersonic flight with no audible boom, it should be allowed. Full stop. If there's an audible boom, then reasonable people might differ about is it too loud or not, and that's a complex conversation.
Which goes to your point on the auditory regulation should have been where we would have landed if we were trying to do a societal good around this back in 1973. If Boeing was, it's like, okay, let's focus on the noise element of it, and instead we focused on the speed element of it, which is theoretically an input into the noise element, but not.
Not directly, right? The thing that should obviously be allowed is boomless supersonic flight. And by the way, this is a concept that's been around kind of theoretically in academia for a long time, but now we've done it. And so that's something that I'll show you the picture and we'll put it up on screen. So we broke the sound barrier on our prototype airplane earlier this year. It's called the XB-1. It is the first supersonic jet made not by a nation state. It's the first one made out of airliner ready technology. It's the first civil supersonic jet since 1969. And it's the first one ever made in America.
For people listening, we'll show it on, or watching, we'll show it on screen for people listening. It basically looks like a boat with a wake behind it almost, are those the sound waves or what am I
there's what they're called shock waves. Basically, I'll be nerdy for a second here. The best question that nobody asks is, what does the speed of sound have to do with an airplane? And the answer is the speed of sound is the speed at which pressure waves move in air. And airplanes are all about pressure waves. If you're flying less than the speed of sound, there is a pressure wave in front of the airplane that's basically nudging air out of the way before the airplane gets there. If you're flying supersonic, that means the airplane's outrunning the pressure wave, which means when it smacks into the air, it compresses it. And so you get these little bands of compressed air that come off the airplane. And the way they stack up on top of each other as they go from the airplane down to the ground, it can create this sort of constructive interference. It creates this sort of like N-shaped wave that is heard on the ground as a sonic boom.
So you've been at this for 11 years?
Very nearly, yeah.
Nearly 11 years. And you recently had your first flight that broke the sound barrier?
That's right, yeah.
And so what is the business forward from here? So we're looking at, we got in front of us this United plane. Mm-hmm. Like, I guess where do things sit from a timeline, commercial applicability?
Yeah, I mean, so I think where we are now is we've really had supersonic aviation's Falcon 1 moment. And the Falcon 1 was that was the first SpaceX rocket that made it to orbit. And so what we did on XB-1, I think in some ways was even more meaningful because there was a human on board. The first three Falcon 1s blew up, and it was okay because they were unmanned. But we have a pilot on board our airplane. Of course, we're going to have passengers on board the product airplane, so failure is not an option. So we demonstrated it could be done by a small team with a relatively small amount of capital, and that the technology actually exists. And moreover, we can do it without an audible sonic boom. And so what's next? Well, it's time to go big. This is a business that was, to this point, funded by VCs investing their own money, to kind of get to the right point of demonstration that the technology is there and the team can really do it. And now it's time to scale up and go big and build the airplane that you and I get to fly on. And, we will start building the first full-scale airplane next year, and our goal is to have it in the air by the end of 28 and ready for passengers by the end of 29. So we are, if we look at technically where the development is, we are a few months ago where the Boeing 777 was 5 years before it carried passengers. So if we execute as well as 1990s Boeing, it's less than 5 years for you and I can buy a ticket and break the sound barrier.
And what is the relationship with United?
United was first to place an order with a deposit. And I have an enormous amount of gratitude for the leadership team at United that had the vision to place an order for supersonic jets during COVID. And it was really Scott Kirby and Mike Leskinen who looked at COVID and said, everyone else is retrenching. This is actually the time to build for the future. And so they made a couple of bold bets. They made a bet on supersonic flight, and they made a bet on eVTOL, and they were willing to put their money behind the bet and put their brand behind the bet. And so so United ordered 15 overtures. They pre-ordered another 35. And most important, they're actually working with us on the airplane development. So the United team is deeply involved in our development. When we do technical reviews, United comes to them. Their pilots fly the simulator. They give us feedback. Their flight attendants look at how the galleys work, help us make sure that those are going to be great. So is an airplane, an airplane has a million decisions that go into it in creating the product. And if I contrast Boom with, say, a SaaS company, the thing about a SaaS, there's this sort of falsehood that SaaS companies are less capital intensive than deep tech. But if you look at like the money consumed by an Uber or a Lyft or an Airbnb versus the capital consumed by like a SpaceX or an Anduril, it turns out the SaaS companies actually consume more VC. But there is an important difference, which is how much capital do you need to demonstrate product market fit with a shipping product?
Yeah, to get to the zero to one, that's something.
Yeah. So you can build an Uber and see if anybody wants to use it.
Sure.
For a small amount of money. And if it doesn't work, well, people lose their seed money, but that happens all the time and it's okay. You can't test product market fit on a supersonic airplane by shipping it. You have to test it differently. And so one of our very early insights was, we basically needed Kickstarter for supersonic aviation. And so getting orders with real non-refundable deposits and getting the airlines to lock hands with us and be part of the development program such that we're not going to ship another Concorde that they don't want, that their passengers can't afford. We call it the three-legged stool. There's the technical execution of the airplane, which in many ways is the easiest part. Like, people have been building supersonic jets for a long time. We just have to build it capitally efficiently. But then there's the, what are airlines really going to be able to operate profitably, and what are passengers going to pay for? And getting those three things in sync is really important. Should it be a little bit more seats, a little bit less seats? Do you want a little bit more range, a little bit less range? all of those decisions really matter. And we needed to prove to ourselves that we are, what we were building has product market fit before we're done physically building it.
It's impressive. I mean, you've sold more, you've pre-sold more planes than Concorde ever sold.
We have the first 5 years of production in the books.
And so how much capital have you consumed to date, raised, consumed?
Yeah, we've consumed about $450 million. Which makes it, by a large margin, the most efficient supersonic development program in history. Yeah. We did XB1 with 50 people, including the engineers that designed it, the technicians that put it together, the test pilots, all of that. And we've also designed a full-scale jet engine. We've designed the full-scale airplane. We have a factory, an almost 200,000 square foot factory in North Carolina. We've done a lot for about $450 million.
And so what stands in between now and me being able to go on a plane?
It's scaling up the engineering. Just a few weeks ago, we hit what's called config freeze, meaning we broke the engineer's pencils and said, you're done optimizing, it's time to go build. So there is a slightly refined version of this airplane. I think to the layman, you wouldn't notice the difference, but it actually takes a bunch of lessons we learned from the XB1 test plane, folds it into Overture. And so we're now doing the more detailed engineering. Next year, we'll start building parts. Around the end of this year, we'll have the first full-scale engine running on a test stand. And then we will take it through an enormous amount of testing. We'll do as much as we can on the ground. What we have to do in the air, we'll do in the air. And then all along the way, we're working with the FAA and generating their buy-in so that when we're all done, everyone agrees it's ready for passengers.
And plus or minus, like, what is the shelf life of an airplane? Like, what is it? What do they typically sell for? Can you just give a sense of economics?
So a typical Boeing 200-seat wide-body airplane, like a 787, after all the discounts, it's on the order of $150 million. Mm-hmm. And the time to pay back on that for an airline is about a decade. We sell...
And they last for how long?
Decades.
Decades.
By the way, which is a demonstration of the lack of innovation. Like, they should be obsolete long before they wear out, but they're not. The product cycles have gotten, the innovation is so poor that the products have a very long shelf life, longer than they really should have.
It's pretty remarkable, like, to think about decades plus products that we use in other, I mean, televisions 10 years ago, just 20 years ago, just look ridiculous compared to today. You would never use it, even though they're functional enough to work.
In the 1960s, the average time an airliner would stay in service was about 6 years. Not because they fell apart, but because there was a new one that was better that you wanted to upgrade to, right? One of our biggest goals at Boom is to speed up the innovation cycles and to shorten the development costs and timeline for new airplanes so we can iterate much faster, ship newer products much faster. Like Overture is like the first of what's going to be a whole family of products. We're going to build a smaller one that's a private jet. We'll build a larger one that can have a coach cabin in it. There will be a whole family of airplanes, just the same way Boeing and Airbus have a whole family of airplanes. And Overture is just the starting point.
So if we look forward in our lifetime, let's say 25, 30 years, what do you hope the future of travel looks like?
There's going to be a lot more travel. So trivia question. When Uber launched in San Francisco and started out with black cars, what percentage of the black car market did they take?
Within what period of time?
A year or so.
I don't know the answer to it. I would guess that, I mean, over time, it's much greater than 100%.
You were the first person I've asked that question if we got that right.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that.
But yeah, I usually hear things somewhere between 10% and 70%, and the actual answer is 300%.
Yeah.
And so, you know, people talk in AI about Jevons' Law now, about when you reduce the cost of something, demand goes way up. But really, there's a broader principle, which is when you reduce the friction of something, demand goes way up. And cost is an element, accessibility is an element. And I think what we're going to see with air travel is the market for supersonic jets is much, much larger than the market for subsonic jets. Because when flights are faster, people travel more. And you know, we can look back in history because this is, by the way, this happened before. It happened in the 1960s when we went from propeller airplanes to jets. Flights got twice as quick and travel went up sixfold. Nobody went to Hawaii before there were jets. Took too long to get there. Hmm. You know, and now it's like, okay, what about Sydney? Oh, who wants to go to Sydney? Takes so darn long. What if you could go to Sydney as quickly as you could go to Honolulu? Hmm. What if you could go to London, have a dinner meeting, and come home and tuck your kids in the same night? What if our kids could grow up in a world where they actually have friends in other continents that they've spent time with? What would happen if there's a factory in Asia that produces a product and in less than 24 hours, it could be back on the desk of the engineer that designed it? Like right now, that takes 48 hours. We'd actually double the rate of iteration. The second order effects of supersonic flight will absolutely destroy the first order effects. And so I think, you know, to go back to your question, that the future is supersonic flight's not special. It's just normal. It's how we all fly. And we do a lot more flying. And the speed up that kicked off in the air ricocheted on the ground. We figured out how to build much more efficient airports. You can imagine you could arrive at the terminal 20 minutes before your flight without worrying you're going to miss it. All of that will put more liquidity in the travel ecosystem, more demand, more flights, more passengers. That means more frequency of flights, which means more choice of when you leave and when you arrive. And that flywheel starts spinning. And it's the flywheel that started spinning in the 1960s with jets, and then it just kind of slowly coasted down because we haven't gotten any better. And it's the flywheel that Concorde never started because it wildly missed on product.
In some ways, regulation at this point is a moat or an advantage for you all in that you had to go through all these different hoops to kind of get to where you are. Do you agree with? You might not morally agree with it.
Not really. I mean, so we designed everything we're doing to make it easy for our regulators. And, you know, a thing I always tell the team is regulators are humans too. They want to work on things that are exciting. They want to be involved. They want to put their fingerprints on the things they work on, and they want to feel trusted and able to trust. So with XB1, what we did was we involved FAA from when it was on paper to when it was a bucket of parts to when it rolled out to when it was ready to fly. And we said, FAA, we're ready to, you know, we always said, come anytime you want, look at anything you want to see, talk to anybody. There are no secrets here. And when we said we're ready, they gave us the paperwork the day that we asked for it. Why? It wasn't some miracle. It was common sense. Build trust, build buy-in as we go, and then it's not a big deal. And by the way, this is a high-profile program. If we screwed it up, it would make the regulators look really bad. So it's all the more important that we build trust as we go. But this isn't rocket science. This is just human relationships and doing good work and being transparent about the work. And when there's a problem, be open about it. When there's a tough decision, involve the regulators in the decision.
If you could wave a magic wand for regulations that exist, or maybe elements of FAA and different considerations to make it easier to do what you've been able to do, is there one thing that stands out?
There, oh, yes. Repeal the ban on supersonic flight.
And where does that currently stand? I know Elon Musk said it's something that should happen under this administration.
Yeah. I mean, I've been at the White House four times this year. I've been all over Capitol Hill. I've met with multiple cabinet secretaries. It's going to happen.
Hmm. That's great. What's been the hardest part of getting to where you are today?
It's not the engineering. It's not even the financing. It is building a startup team in an industry that has not had a startup in a century. And so we have to find people who are incredibly good technically, but also have the right, I'll just call it startup gearing ratio, to move fast, to be efficient. And this is part of why I said earlier that I thought Concorde destroyed supersonic and Apollo destroyed space exploration. And part of the insidious way they did that was by creating an entire industry that had no cost pressure. And there are all these like cost plus government contracts. And so if you're operating on a time and materials contract, you're incentivized to use more time and to use more materials. And you don't want to embarrass the customer, so you don't want to take a risk and fail. And so all of that has led to a bunch of just calcification. You know, I'm sure we all see the same headlines about just Boeing and their struggles, but the whole industry has elements of that. So we had to learn how to build a team where the incumbents were culturally the antithesis of what we needed to be.
Where have you found these people from that comprise like the core? Yeah. I don't know. Like, are these people that are similar to you in background that maybe came up in traditional tech world and then pursued this as an interest area, or are they more Boeing entrepreneurial people?
I'm not aware of any Boeing entrepreneurial people.
Okay, there you go. That's easy.
So it's not that. Take that one off the table. So we have some people from SpaceX. We have some, we care about what you can do, not what's on your resume. We care if you've solved a hard problem and you're passionate and smart and curious and learn quickly, and driven by the mission. You know, so for example, the guy that, cracked the code on some really difficult landing gear engineering issues previously worked on janitorial equipment at a different company. I remember when I interviewed him, I looked at his resume and I'm like, why is the team having me talk to this guy? And then I had the conversation. I was like, oh, I get it. This guy is way bigger than a power mop. Is a brilliant mechanical designer. And so what we've tried to find really talented people from just anywhere. And, we also, we find people who went to Boeing by accident, earlier in their careers before they got corrupted. Like we hired, another guy who ended up being a very talented mechanical designer who reached out to me and said, well, I went to Boeing because I wanted to work on a supersonic airplane and somehow I didn't realize that would never happen. Can I please come to Boom? This is what I really want to do. And there are a handful of stories like that as well. But we also take young people and we put them in absurdly big roles and they can do it.
Resumes are something of a, or companies in general are something of a filtering mechanism. When we talk about how good it actually is, colleges, same thing, right? We can certainly rail on that probably for a while, but I'm curious, like how, as a sorting mechanism of talent, I assume you guys get a fair number of people coming through the doors, applying, I guess. Everyone I know probably aspires to find the undiscovered talent, the undiscovered gems within that could be at their company and really scale. It's hard to go pursue just people from SpaceX or Stripe or whatever it is, one of those businesses exclusively. And so I guess as a filtering mechanism, do you guys take a disproportionate number of first calls when people come through the door? Like, how do you actually make this a practice that you can go through and try to find the undiscovered gems?
There's sort of multiple, there's no single answer to this. One part is we keep our eyes open for high agency candidates. So like people email me, directly, and some of the best people we've ever hired have been cold emails to me. And so I place a lot of value on a well-written cold outreach. So that's kind of one avenue on it. Another is, and Brian Chesky talks about this a lot. Starting with the work and reverse engineering the human. Like if there's a thing that we admire that is out there in the world, let's figure out who really did it and talk to them. You know, another twist on this is that the way I got the initial team. So, I wasn't from the industry. Like my last job, it's become a joke now. My last job, I was a product manager at Groupon. And I remember going to LinkedIn and filtering for industry equals aerospace, connection equals first degree. No results. I didn't know a soul in the industry, not a soul. So, okay, second degree. Well, there was somebody who now worked at SpaceX who had played hockey in college with one of my directs at Groupon. Okay, great. Maybe I can get that meeting. Is that a strong enough connection to get a good intro? I'll try. And I flew down to Hawthorne in LA where SpaceX headquarters is. My only cred was I showed up in an airplane that I had flown myself, a little single engine. This was my only cred on day one. I had my pilot's license. And I sat with him and I explained what I was doing and why I thought it made sense. And, he got pretty excited. And I said, Jamie, if you could wave a magic wand and get anybody in the world to come be in the trenches with me on this, and you're not thinking about whether they'd want to, you're not thinking about whether I can afford them, you're not thinking about whether they have a job that they're happy about now. All you're thinking about is, who would you absolutely want in the trench with you fighting this battle, making this thing? Who would be your top five? And he said, he'd think about it. And on the flight back to Palo Alto, my phone buzzed and I had five names. And so I met those five people and I asked them the same question. And I was sort of recursively searching my network for the best people. And you know, there's that old joke about, you know, everybody's 6 degrees to Kevin Bacon. Turns out everybody's also 6 degrees to the very best people in aviation. And so when I would tell people I was building a supersonic passenger jet, the first question was always, are you crazy? And people would rarely ask it out loud, but I could always tell it was the first question. And there was this other like the meme amongst like aviation people that there are always these internet guys with like crackpot airplane ideas. And I remember when I met the guy who became our first chief engineer, I showed him the work I'd done on a market sizing and on technical feasibility. And he looked at it and he says, wow, I didn't think you'd be this far. And I'm used to hearing a lot of airplane ideas that make no sense. This one actually makes sense. And then he wanted me to hire him as a consultant. And I was like, nope, like, you're either in or you're out, dude. And he couldn't stop himself. He just like started building his own spreadsheets and his own models. He just could not help himself from working on this. And he became our first chief engineer.
Along the way, I'm sure you've made a bunch of different trade-offs. Is there one that you feel was really a fork in the road that you're particularly happy you made?
Yeah. We were insanely ambitious in our choices for what to target with our first prototype airplane. That made the job far harder.
What to target? How so?
So we said we're going to go fly it. The original design was 10% faster than Concorde, incorporated one passenger seat. It had all these like requirements on it that on paper were very achievable. But we did not appreciate where the real breakpoints were in challenge, including we decided to put a person on it. Like if we'd made a supersonic drone and the only goal was to like build a thing that looks like an airplane that breaks the sound barrier, oh boy, it would have been so much easier. Also, we would have learned way less and proven way less. The most important thing we learned from XB1, two things. One was how to build a safety culture, hugely important, easier to say than it is to actually do. And number two, we learned where the real breakpoints in practicality were. And so when we said, okay, great, now we're ready to scale up to the airliner, we were able to make far more pragmatic choices. We backed off a little bit on speed. We went from Mach 2.2 to Mach 1.7. Why? Well, at 1.7, we can use completely off-the-shelf materials that were already certified for the 787. We don't need to qualify even the same materials for different operating environments. It's far easier to meet the same noise regulations that apply to subsonic jets for takeoff and landing at 1.7 than it is at 2.2. At 1.7, the aspect ratio on the wing can be wider, meaning a higher wingspan. That makes stability and control for takeoff and landing dramatically easier. One of the technical challenges on XB1 was at a Mach 2.2, you have this very slender airplane, slender wing, long, skinny fuselage. It's hard to make stuff fit. And at 1.7, which by the way means another 15 minutes across the Atlantic, it's not that big of a deal, all of those things get easier. And along the way, taking all that thinking, remembering this is not a one-trick pony. We're going to ship an airplane and a 0.1 revision and a 0.2 revision and then a 2.0 and a 3.0. We don't have to put every good idea on 1.0, that we can really embrace the M and MVP, minimum viable product. And that allowed us, that plus the experience in XB1 allowed us to be far more pragmatic about what we're doing.
What's been the most counterintuitive lesson you've learned along the way?
The most surprising thing that I never would have predicted was that an airline would place an order and give us money before we ever flew an airplane. I have guaranteed on day one that would never happen, but yet it did. Thanks, Scott. Thanks, Mike.
Do you think this happens ex-COVID, that they're like thinking about and taking into all the consideration, or you think that was a unique confluence of events?
I think we've always found, so we when we were going through YC, we did a pre-order deal with Virgin that we like unveiled on demo day, like $2 billion LOI from Virgin. We got a pre-order from Japan Airlines actually before United. United was the first to put money in with an order. So why Virgin? Why Japan Airlines? Why United? Why American after that? There is a specific answer why that team with that set of humans at that point in time wanted to do the thing that did with us. And the answer is different for Richard Branson than it was for United, different from what it was for Japan Airlines. But at each point, we caught them in the right moment where this created real value for them, short-term and long-term. When I met Richard Branson, there's a whole story of how I managed to basically crash a Virgin event to get time with him. I explained to Richard what we were doing. We had a little model of the airplane with a Virgin logo on it. And, you know, he sat back in his chair and he says, "Wow, guys, this is brilliant. Like, I love it. But like, I'm doing this Virgin Galactic thing. Like, I don't think I've got it in me to do two of these." And I said, "Richard, no. I'm not asking you for your money. I'm not even asking for your belief that we're going to pull this off. All I'm asking is, when it works, would you like the first one to be for Virgin? And if you're willing to say, 'Yes, I want this,' I'll go get all the money somewhere else. I don't need your money. I just need your belief in the product, that it makes sense given everything you know about airlines." And he said yes to that. And there was a similar story with Japan Airlines in a different way. And that deal took a year and a half versus the Virgin deal took 8 weeks. But there's always a reason to why. And you got to find the company and the team in the right place. Like, United wanted to build their story and their plan for how to make United the greatest airline ever. And I think that's actually one of the many things that's brilliant about Scott's leadership, is he doesn't tell the team at United, "Be the best airline." That's actually not that inspiring today. He says, "Be the best airline in history." And that framing causes the team to rise to the occasion. And it causes them to think much more ambitiously about everything they do. Well, the best airline in history would have a faster airplane.
The Symphony system that you guys have built out, can you describe to people what that was? And then I'm curious, was that an entirely new design, or was it based on something existing?
So Symphony is our full-scale custom jet engine. There is still, if you said, "What's the stink on Boom?" Like, I think we still have the biggest stink around engine. Because there is this mythology, I think perpetuated by the big three engine companies, that only the big three engine companies can build jet engines. And I think we made the mistake along the way of flirting with them. We publicly sort of dated with Rolls-Royce. And so the world kind of thought that it was going to be a Rolls engine. And I think when I made the mistake of feeding into that narrative, what we found along the way was a startup working with a 100-year-old company was a really bad idea. They didn't want to build us a custom engine. They were only kind of shoehorn what they already had. And so we got to a point where we said, "You know what? We're going to do this the SpaceX way. We're going to take control of our own destiny. And, we will happily create for you a face-saving way off the program. Maybe we'll license something from you, but then we'll lock arms and kind of, wave goodbye and give each other a hug." And then what actually happened was United placed an order. About a year later, American placed a bigger order, and we were still incubating our own engine effort. We weren't ready to show it to the world yet, and Rolls freaked out, and they ran to the press and said, "There is no supersonic market. We're not interested." I think because they didn't want to, the market was clearly coming together, and they weren't going to be part of it. It was one of the darkest moments in Boom history, because the world was like, "Ha ha! Boom has no engine. They're building a supersonic glider." My team wanted to just say everything we actually thought. Instead, we said we were grateful to Rolls for our work, and we'll show you our engine when we're good and ready. And then we eventually did announce our own engine program, and it's just like the rest of the airplane. This is all proven technology. There's nothing new on it, materials wise or science wise. It's just custom. And because it's fully custom, it is much, much better. So the whole boomless cruise thing would not be possible if we weren't doing our own engine, because the key thing is it's got to be able to break the sound barrier at a sufficiently high altitude. That comes down to something called transonic performance. With a modified Rolls engine, we could only break the sound barrier at 26,000 feet. Boomless doesn't work. With our own engine, we can do it well above 30. And it's a complete game changer because it can do supersonic over land with no boom. And that would not have happened if we hadn't said, all right, yes, we're going to follow in SpaceX footsteps. We're going to build not just our own vehicle, but our own engine too. People still think we're crazy for this, but like the actual craziness was entertaining any other plan.
And what is the big, I guess, what was the timeline of how that went, when that played out, like the initial conversation with Rolls through the breakup?
Yeah, I mean, it was, on day zero, our plan was to build our own engine. And then I'm accountable for this. I made the mistake of thinking, ooh, if there's a modifiable engine, wouldn't that be easier? And, wouldn't it be nice to have the brand association? Because we're trying to convince the world that like we have any shot of pulling this off, right? And so we're executing like crazy, but anything that adds credibility, we're like, I made the mistake of getting too thirsty for it. And so we kind of, continue to go down paths with Rolls, but like, it looked great on the outside. But a startup in a big British company is just not, the gears don't mesh well. And a supersonic airplane really wants a fully custom engine. I think it was 2022 that kind of it all became public. And then, where we are now, we're building our first custom engine right now. And it'll be running on a test stand around the end of the year. And so we will, I'm sure it will be challenging, but the world will find out soon whether a startup can build a supersonic jet engine.
What's the biggest difference between what you will have versus what currently exists in a commercial airline?
It is a thing that is, I think, easy to miss coming from the software world is how important sizing is to physical engineering. Well, what do I mean by sizing? Well, so Overture has a turbofan engine, meaning there's a jet engine core that powers a fan that blows air around the core of the engine. Okay. Well, which turbofan? What are the design parameters? What's the fan diameter? What's the actual size of the fan? How much air goes around the core versus through the core? What's the pressure ratio? What's the design operating temperature? And these are all choices. You can turn these knobs. You can make a bigger fan, a smaller fan, a bigger core, a smaller core. And a subsonic airplane tends to want a big fan and a small core. And a supersonic airplane tends to want a medium-sized fan and a big core. And it's the same stuff. It's just different. Mm. Different sizing. Our fan blades are smaller than other people's fan blades. Our core is approximately the same size as the largest cores that have been done. We're very careful not to go outside the bounds of what's been done before. We don't want to stumble off and like, oops, we're building the world's largest single crystal castings. Nope, not on version one.
What's something that's maybe looks simple from the outside with the Overture, I guess, in general, mm-hmm. That is actually insanely complex?
Low speed. The high speed's the easy part. The low speed's the hard part. Everything for high speed, it drives you towards long, slender airplanes. It drives you towards skinny engines. And all of those things are the exact opposite of what you want for quiet, low speed takeoff and landing. So that the art is two airplanes in one. It can go fast and it can go slow. The fast part's easier than the slow part. And we spent a lot of energy on XB1 working out low speed stability and control. But all of those lessons, you just scale up very directly. And with our sort of backing off a little bit on top speed, it actually get a lot easier.
On the business side of things, we talked a lot about the Concorde and some of the mistakes that they made. And it seems like you guys are taking a vastly different approach to it. So as you've been talking to United and other folks that are interested in placing orders around this, like how much of of the business model or the price points and the considerations on all this? How much have you come to them with, like, hey, here's how we think it should work. Here's a price point that we've sort of thought through. Here's the implications, versus they came to you. And I guess, where have those things met in the middle? Like, what are we sort of talking about? Number of flights, price point?
All yeah. Those. So our approach was, we actually built a team out of ex-airline analysts. And we said, let's do all the work that we would expect an airline to do in evaluating the product before we ever call them. So,
you know, and when was this in the journey? Like, how long ago?
So I personally did this in 2014, like a baby version.
This is maybe what you showed up at SpaceX with, some of the early.
Yeah. I had a spreadsheet model of the airplane technically, and I had a spreadsheet model of the airline economics and the overall market sizing. And that was something I built myself in Google Sheets with a bit of JavaScript code and some screen scraping of like market data out of FlightAware. And today we have pros doing the same thing. And it's far more sophisticated, but it gives basically the same answer. And so we would show up to an airline and we'd say, let's just show you the math here. Here's the vision. Let me show you the math. This is what the airplane can do. If you make this fare assumption, this is how that sits relative to market fares. This is how many people we think will fly on it. These are the routes where we think it makes sense. This is how you would schedule the airplane. This is how many round trips you can do. This is why you can fill those. Here are the departure times, the arrival times, how it fits into your banking structure. We kind of did all the work. And because of that, they're like, oh, it kind of makes sense. And of course, they'd have like bits of feedback around the edges. But I think, you know, I think if we'd said, hey, United, what airplane do you want? We never would have gotten anywhere.
And so the price point for the consumers will net out about where?
About like business class today.
About like business.
So, you know, Concorde, $20,000 ticket, uncomfortable seat. Overture, $5,000 ticket, really nice seat. The one thing it doesn't do for a transatlantic flight is lie fully flat. Because when the flight's 3.5-4 hours, you don't need a flat bed. Just the same way you don't have a flat bed on a domestic flight that's 3 hours.
So have you spoken publicly about the interior design and what that's going to look like?
We have a little bit, but we have a couple things that are still under the wraps. I'll share a bit. So Concorde, if you've ever gone on one at a museum, the first impression is terrible. It's got a really short boarding door. Most people have to duck to get on. There's the equivalent of several rows of floor-to-ceiling equipment racks and a narrow aisle. So you just have to squeeze your human into this airplane. And by the time you get to your seat, you're already just emotionally convinced it's tiny and cramped. And the seat's not great. So we said, look, we want to build something that passengers are going to want to fly over and over and over again. And the first impression has to be great. And the in-seat experience has to be great. And so we do have a long, skinny airplane with a very unusual shape. It's actually bigger in the front and skinnier in the back. The back of the airplane, the very last row of seats, is the same diameter as like the best Gulfstream. And in the front, the boarding door is actually 10 inches taller than Concorde's, an inch taller than a 737. And you step on board the widest part of the airplane where there are these like 8-foot cathedral ceilings. So it's a great first impression. And then there is the front cabin has something I can't share yet. It was a collaboration between design and engineering that changed the aerodynamics of the airplane slightly, but created something that I think when people see for the first time, they'll be like, no way.
From a consumer experience
From a consumer experience
side. So as we look here, so is it 2 and 2 through here? How is it laid out?
That'd be one way to do it.
Got it. As you get near the back, as it narrows, I guess, let me ask this a different way. Are there different seating as you?
Yeah. So the back is 1+1, and actually the best seats are in the back of the airplane. Every seat's a window seat and an aisle seat. We actually, again, there's magic that happens when designers think like engineers and engineers think like designers. So one of the things we did is we changed the structural frame spacing on the fuselage to line up with the interior. So the windows always line up with the seats. And this is, you know, this is not done today. And we have that sometimes you get lucky and there's a window where you want the window to be. Sometimes it's like, well, the window is kind of halfway between rows and you can't get a good view.
And what's the reason for that? for in a Boeing plane or whatever?
The interior and the airplane itself are developed independently by like different companies. Yeah, and there's a lot of like principal agent kind of problems.
Yeah, got it. So I end up with two windows angled slightly weirdly and someone else ends up with no windows or whatever. That's interesting.
Right. Yeah. And versus we design the interior and the airplane together.
In terms of the actual like design, we spent a lot of time sort of talking about the different technical considerations, regulatory considerations, and all that stuff. As you moved into the consumer experience, how opinionated were you about these things? Did you bring in different consultants or different hiring once you sort of realized the commercial viability and you started to make plans for the actual, you know, commercial availability?
So we built a design team that had never done an airplane before. And we brought in a few consultants that had, so they would, you know, teach us what we didn't know about, you know, say certification for crashworthiness. But mostly, it was me and a handful of, really great designers, thinking very aspirationally about what we could create and just really sweating the details. You know, one of my favorite, just, you know, favorite days at Boom is when I go from a deep technical meeting where I'm just working with the team on, say how we design the approach to landing for quiet operation and without compromising high speed performance. It's like fascinating little technical problem right in there, and it's like right at the intersection of regulation and engineering and pilot experience. And then I go to the next meeting, and we're looking at a mock up of the windows, and we're talking about the design of the interior and how the airplane sidewall interfaces with the window and how we can reduce seams and gaps to create a visual experience that is far more tranquil. And so there is, one of the things I just very much love about this company is, there is a lot of art, and design and ineffability. You know, how do we make it a sensory experience that's pleasant? How do we make this an oasis in the cacophony that is an airport? And also there's just like the most awesome physics and engineering and manufacturing. And that all can be in, you know, all can be in one day. And the magic happens the more these are threads that are woven together and cross-pollinate. And the more we, you know, like one of our big things is no silos. And I expect every person at Boom to be not just be an expert in their own discipline, but to be curious about every other one. See, this is, again, a difference between physical products and software. Everything's a trade-off. If we make the fuselage wider, it will create more aerodynamic drag and fuel economy will get worse. Range of the airplane gets worse and the required fares go up. So there's a tension between making the airplane bigger and more spacious and making it more cost-effective. And the, you know, you could look at this as a tug of war, or you could look at it as what we call invent together. And invent together is like one of our five values. And it means everybody on the team has the obligation to teach what they know and to learn from what their peers know. And a belief that when there is a shared understanding of every side of every trade-off, that's where the magic gets found. And like this thing I'm not quite telling you about the front cabin of the airplane came out of one of these. Where it's just like, you know, when I saw it, there was like, a no way. Wait a minute, that could really work?
We've talked about the initial going and meeting the gentleman from SpaceX and the cascading effects of trying to find five and then five along the way. 11 years in, you've had to retain these people or different people with different points of validation from the outside and probably different people feeling like they were making a ton of progress or maybe like, where is this going at different points in the journey? I'm curious on the talent retention side, like what have you learned about keeping people going through what probably has felt like manic episodes at different points along the way?
Yeah, boy, we could do like probably three podcasts just on this question because I've made plenty of mistakes along the way, and I've also learned some important lessons. I'll share a couple. One is what we're doing requires a lot of perseverance and a lot of grit. And rational people will give up if they don't care about the mission, because it's just too it's just too tough. And so one of the most important things we've done all along the way is to select for people who really, really care about delivering mainstream supersonic flight. Is that if they don't and they're sane, they're going to leave and go do something far easier. So that's one. The other is was less obvious. It's about burnout. So I'll tell you the story of how I learned the lesson. This was 2020. We were about to roll out the XB1 airplane, and to plan a proper event, you know, we had to call the shot on when rollout was going to be months in advance, so you could do all the media planning and all the event prep for it. So we called the shot. I think it was October 20th, and the airplane wasn't ready when we called the shot, so we had to work like crazy to get this to be ready. And the engineers were working like crazy. The people on the shop floor were working 7 day weeks, 12 hour days, at literally polishing the airplane. Like if you go back and look at the reveal video in XB1, we revealed it in a light box with these long skinny light bars. And those are the least forgiving lighting environment for a physical product. If there's any surface imperfection, it will be really obvious. So like people are literally polishing the airplane, and an insane amount of effort. And so we had an awesome event, and I said, all right, everybody take a week off, because then we're going to come back and the next job is to fly the airplane. They came back, and morale, which had been really high, was suddenly in the tank. And at first I was like, WTF people. Like, you just got a bunch of external validation. The world is so excited about what we're doing. And I gave you all a week off. So what are you telling me you're burned out for? And at first I was like very upset. And what I realized was that what everyone tells you about burnout is actually not what burnout really is. Burnout is not, I'm working too hard. And in fact, teams can work extreme high intensities for long periods of time without being burned out, so long as there is a believable, tangible goal that is within what I call their gratification window. And I think as humans, we all have a gratification window. Some people have long gratification windows. Some people have short gratification windows. But is how far away can a motivating goal be for me to believe in it and for it to actually motivate me? And what we went from was like, oh, it is like a couple months to weeks away from a very important deadline that I know if I work really hard, I can hit, to, ooh, this airplane that we just rolled out needs a lot of work before it's really ready to fly. I don't even know how to get my head around that plan. And so the solution was we engineered something called mission success events, which is basically every roughly month, there were one or two major milestones that the team could rally around and celebrate and enjoy. And we still do this today. And one of the things is a mission success event is not just celebrated by the team that did it, but it's celebrated by the whole company. And we try to have like maybe like three a month across the whole company. And everyone gets together and celebrates. And it's a whole company victory. And so there is a very long marathon divided into sprints. And you can think of it as, you get to take a shot at the end of every sprint. Sometimes literally.
We've spent a lot of time talking about all the different component parts and developing airlines and all of that. I recently, obviously, there's been the implications of tariffs kind of roiling through the economy. I get the feeling you have opinions about different elements of this. So one, can you share, we were talking a little bit before about the bitter pill element of what tariffs maybe will accomplish.
Yeah. I've changed my mind a lot on this. I think I booted up very much a unabashedly free trade, pro-globalization. Let's have one big happy world. We embrace comparative advantage. Not everything needs to be built in any one place. The world's a better place like that. And I think I'm on this multi-year journey of realizing that the world is, that is definitely the world I want to live in, but it's not the world we actually live in. Russia invaded Ukraine. China has an explicit goal of taking over Taiwan. We lived for, you know, post-World War II, post-Cold War, a few decades of relative peace, but the world is not a safe place. Not every country is free, and there are real-life bad guys. And what has happened, so let's go back to World War II. The way we won World War II was not by having a bunch of defense companies ready to go or having a big stockpile of weapons. We had no defense companies and we had no stockpiles. But what we had was the best commercial industrial base in the world. And companies like Boeing and Douglas pivoted into defense products. Ford retooled and they built fighters and bombers and tanks. And we outproduced the Axis and we won. And then we lost our way. We went into this defense. I think Eisenhower very appropriately warned about the military industrial complex. We put the defense industrial base in corporate welfare. Defense programs became as much as anything jobs programs. We got really fat and dumb. In a shooting war with China, we'd run out of stockpiled cruise missiles in 8 days, and it would take another 2 years to get one. And meanwhile, the efficient, agile industrial base has left America and it's gone to China. And this is, I find this incredibly scary. And like it's happened in a lot of industries. Aviation, we all know it happened with chips. Like chips went to Asia. It's a huge problem, very hard to get them back. And we are watching right now the same thing happen in slow motion with aviation. But China today is shipping a 737 clone. They are working on a 787 clone. And they just announced last weekend, the next thing after that, yep, it's a supersonic passenger plane. And Boeing, on the other hand, America, has not shipped a new airliner in decades. The 787 launched, I think, 2004. Nothing new. And pretty soon the world will be first Chinese knockoff airplanes and that every other country will buy because they're cheap. We can tariff them in the U.S., but you can't stop that internationally. And then we'll be all surprised that they've caught up with us technologically and they're ahead. And the I cannot overemphasize the importance of this. Boeing is the number one U.S. exporter. A quarter of all Air Force airplanes are modified commercial airplanes. So if we don't have next generation airplanes, not only do we not have the exports and the economics, we don't have the next generation defense platforms. This is how we get our tankers. This is how we get our military transports. Even some of our spy planes are modified commercial airplanes. So, okay, you asked about tariffs. I think the most important thing here is reindustrialization. And in a world, it sounds like Mother and Apple Pay, but if we had world peace, this actually wouldn't be important. The planet could operate as one, but that is not the world we live in. And America needs the greatest industrial base on the planet. And I think it's urgent and important, and that what we need to do is pull every lever completely simultaneously. So first off, we need to get out of our own way. Like all this stuff that makes it hard to build, all this stuff that takes a year to do permitting or more, got to get rid of that. Supersonic flight, we got to legalize it. Everything we can do that basically makes it more expensive to build here, we need to fix. We need to fix rapidly. We need to massively cut federal spending, which will cause more capital to flow into private markets where it can be deployed many more times more effectively than any government ever could. And then we need to create economic, and this is the part, I know it's controversial, and I used to be on the exact opposite side of this issue.
By the way, I'm still with you. I haven't disagreed with anything you've said yet. I have a feeling I'm about to.
Okay. I started off thinking, I was in the tariffs are really dumb camp. And I am now in the, this problem is so urgent and important that we need to be willing to do painful things that accelerate the transition. And so I don't think the tariffs that we have as of, like, I don't know, this morning, are the right ones long term. I don't think they're going to stay that way either. But I think what we need to do is accelerate that shift towards reindustrialization. And this is one of several levers that will contribute. And by the way, many of these are painful levers. I think it's a bitter tasting medicine. And I also think it's temporary. It's a little bit of like economic chemo, and it sucks. But then it will work its way through markets. The economy will get realigned. And I shouldn't put a timeline on this, but I'm very optimistic that things look very, very different, you know, 12 to 24 months from now than they do today.
And the tariffs specifically as a mechanism, the broad-based thing that we've seen over the course of the last whatever period of time, I guess, as an accelerant to this, how do you think about that and the inputs and the puts and takes that kind of come with it?
I think one of the things that is important to realize is we're also seeing there are different ways you can plot your way through this, right? Like one is a very surgical approach where, you know, you're like, so maybe, you know, we should figure out exactly which products should be tariffed. Let's make sure we don't tariff like industrial equipment coming into the US from Europe. Let's maybe finish goods out of China in some circumstances, but only, you know, but not the critical minerals. Like there's a surgical approach to this. And like, a lot of people say like, you know, like the surgical approach makes so much more sense. By the way, it would also take forever to figure out. And I think I think what is very Trumpian, I think very Muskian leadership is, someone once described Elon's management style to me as management by thermonuclear explosion, blow everything up and then fix it. And, I think that's a bit of what we have going on now. It was not that there was a view that this is so urgent and important that we will make big blunt moves and then we'll figure it out and it will get refined. And that drives a lot of chaos, and you have to be willing to tolerate wild volatility in the stock markets. I think that the theory is that this will result in actually getting to the best configuration faster. I certainly understand the argument for the surgical mode, and I think we will end up in the surgical state, but we are following a very chaotic path to get to that state.
And is the implication of all of that, therefore, as you sort of talk all that through, is that it might be net detrimental to the overall U.S. economy in terms of just pure GDP, cost of goods sold being as low as they are, but in terms of the ability to withstand shocks and the long-term potential resiliency of the United States, it's just mission critical. So if that's a trade-off, we should make it.
Let's talk about the end state. I think it starts by, let's get really clear on the end state. I think people should be able to agree on the end state. And then we can have reasonable debates about what is the best path to the end state. In my view, the end state is, again, we have to remember the world is not peaceful. If the world was peaceful, a different end state is better. But okay, great. So basically what there needs to be is America needs to be a free country that is the best in the world at making things. Physical products, digital products, inventing the future. And by best, I mean we're going to be really efficient. We need all the economic incentive to be efficient and be good and be innovative and to move fast.
I would just add the distinction, important things. I think we should be the best at making important things.
Well, which things are unimportant?
I don't know. I don't think t-shirts are particularly important. I don't think, there's a lot of different widgets that don't necessarily feel particularly important to me. Toys don't feel particularly important to me.
Don't you have a little boy on the way?
I do. But in the grand scheme of things, I don't think we need to be the best toy manufacturer in the world.
I actually profoundly disagree. One of the great things about toys is they need to be mass produced at low price points for families. And the manufacturing technology that enables scale production of toys might also be really important in wartime.
It could be, potentially. But it's going to be more expensive. Like,
why?
To do it domestically will just be more expensive.
Well, why?
Because we will pay workers more here than we would than we pay to get goods imported.
Great. So let's keep asking why recursively until we eliminate the root causes of cost.
People in Vietnam are willing to accept lower wages for their jobs because of cost of living versus people in the US.
So let's invest heavily in robotics. Let's make Americans the best leveraged workers. Let's effectively promote every American into management, and they can manage a whole bunch of robots and be far more productive than somebody sewing by hand in Vietnam.
It sounds great. I agree with you. Over what period of time, I guess, is the possibility of it?
I don't know if anybody's smart enough to put a number on that. I'm certainly not.
Yeah.
But I think that's the sooner we get there, the better. And this is, you know, it won't be easy, but there is a much, much better future that we can create here. You know, but we have to be willing to tolerate some disruption on the way there, or it might take too long. And again, if it weren't for China, I would have a very different view on this. And a lot less urgency would exist. And therefore, the surgical approach would make a lot more sense.
Well, I have a feeling we probably could do another hour or two just on this topic. But Blake, I really appreciate you doing this. This was a lot of fun. It's a super impressive business you're building. And I'm glad we were able to dive deep into it.
Oh, I really enjoyed the conversation, Logan. Thank you so much.
Thank you.